in the end, you know, people keep saying to me, if you genuinely believe that it would 100% fail, what you were proposing, why or how could you possibly have entertained that? And to me, the decision became very binary. It was either leave them to die a very slow, awful death from starvation, exposure or infection, let alone the psychological terror that that would impart upon them. Or you take them out and probably they'll die, but they'll be anesthetized and asleep when that happens. So essentially euthanizing them. And, you know, I think there's a very pragmatic answer to that question, one or the other.
All right, welcome back. Or welcome to, if you're new here, to the Finding Mastery podcast. I'm Michael Gervais, and by trade and training, I am a sport and performance psychologist. And the whole idea behind these conversations is to learn from people who are committed to both their craft and their inner life. We want to better understand what they're searching for. We want to know their psychological framework, which is really, how do they use their mind? How do they make sense of the world around them, themselves included? And if you want to learn more about how you can train your mind, it's just a quick little reminder here to check out the online psychological training course that I created with the head coach of the Seattle Seahawks, Pete Carroll. And you can find that at findingmastery.net/course. Basically, what we do is you just pull back the curtain and show you, just like we train world-class athletes, how they train their mind, we do the same for you. We show you how to do it. Finding Mastery is brought to you by listening. This is exactly what their app does. It helps you listen to books and content that you might not be able to sit down and actually have the time to read. There was a time early in my career where I remember sitting in the back hallways of my university and being in the library for hours, reading all of the sports psychology literature and research that I could get my hands on. I loved it. I cherished it. The field of sports psychology is just absolutely on a bender right now. It is growing so fast. It is nearly impossible to keep up with all of the research that's coming out. So that's why I love what listening is doing. It's a game changer for me. So the listening app, it lets me listen to anything that's in writing while I'm on the go. Everything from academic papers to books, PDFs, web pages, articles, anything that I put in their app, it reads it to me. It narrates to me. And plus their AI is great. The way that the interface sounds, like, of course, it's not a human that's reading, but it kind of, the AI is so good of what they're doing, it just works. And then there's also this note-taking function. They know that people like us like to take notes. And so it's as simple as when I hear a key idea, I instantly press a button and that section is saved. They've done a really nice job with this product and they've got a great offer for us. Usually they only give a 2-week trial, but because you are listening to Finding Mastery, you get a whole month for free. Check that out, a whole month for free. So I want to encourage you to go check it out, listening.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get started. Again, it's listening.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get 1 month completely free. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Hims. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing simple, convenient, and affordable access to science-informed treatments for erectile dysfunction, known as ED. They also are servicing hair loss, weight loss, and more. Health struggles like ED, they're common, but they can be hard to talk about when it comes to finding a solution. That's why Hims has been a game changer for so many men. The entire process is 100% online. Answer a series of questions on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option for you. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free in a discreet package. No waiting rooms, no pharmacy visits, and no insurance is needed. Plus, you can manage your plan directly on the Hims app. You can track progress and learn more about your conditions and how to treat them from leading medical experts. If you or a loved one has been struggling with ED, I really want to encourage you to go check out Hims. I know ED often has a psychological component to it as well, so be sure that you're stacking some psychological best practices into your daily routine. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/findingmastery. That's Hims, HIMS.com/findingmastery for your personalized ED treatment options. Hims.com/findingmastery. Disclaimer, hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. Now, this week's conversation is with Dr. Richard Harry Harris. He's an Australian anesthesiologist and a cave diver who played a crucial role in the Tham Luang cave rescue. This podcast, it might change you. It might change you in ways because it's going to force you to take a look at the way that you make decisions in your life, and it's going to force you to examine how would you act under the conditions that Dr. Harris, Dr. Harry, as he's known by, how he makes his decisions. So in essence, in 2018, Doc was about to depart on a cave diving holiday with his friend, and they were requested by the Thai government on the advice of British cave diving experts attempting to rescue 12 Thai children and their soccer coach who were trapped in the Tham Luang cave system. And the whole idea is that, like, they are trapped. These two gentlemen, Dr. Harry in particular, from Australia, were the go-tos across the planet. But as this story unfolds, it is absolutely remarkable, the decision-making tree that he had to go through. And so I wanted to speak with Harry to understand, how did he do it? What were the bumpers? What were the frameworks? What were the ways that he was trying to sort out what was right? Was it intuition? Was it science? Was it something else? And really, what gave him the courage to put, well, I'm gonna leave the punchline for later, but what gave him the courage to be able to do what he did? And I think you're going to be fascinated, not only to hear about Dr. Harry's firsthand experience, but also the mental skills that he employed. I mean, we talk about imagery, we talk about the mechanisms for calm, how he generated confidence and deep focus, because there's deep fatigue involved in this thing as well. And one little note here. This is just a heads up. During the first 10 to 15 minutes of the recording, we had a bit of an audio challenge, but it should still be audible for you. And I left it in there because it sets the tone. And then the quality of the recording gets much better, you know, as we get into the heart of the story. So please be patient. I think you're going to find it meaningful for you. So with that, let's jump right into this week's conversation with Dr. Richard Harris. Richard, how are you?
Great, Michael. Thanks for inviting me on the show.
Oh, I'm so excited to spend time with you. I first met you when you left a mark in your skill meets heroism meets readiness to do something extraordinary. Watching what you did and how you navigated and how you conducted yourself. And much of it was left to my imagination because there was not a whole lot of behind the scenes. And then knowing that there was a book and a movie and, you know, that had folded out of it and a podcast that folded out of it. I'm so excited to talk to you. You represent so much to me and I just can't wait to learn from you. So thank you for spending your time.
Well, it's been a bit of a crazy journey, so it's good to chat about it with you. You can tell me some insights into me, hopefully.
Okay. Well, you know what? I'm here to learn too. So let's roll up our sleeves. One of the things that, let's just start with this. So you're an anesthesiologist as well as a cave diver.
That's true.
They seem to be a bit at odds with each other, but I'm hoping that you can link those two. I'm sure that, you know, that divergent path, that dichotomy between the two crafts and practices, they don't seem to make clear sense to me, but I'm sure that there's a link that you've made. Can we just start with that, the linking between those two?
That's really easy, actually, because for me, those two disciplines are extraordinarily similar in many respects. And I think the adage of wartime, you know, 99% boredom and 1% terror can apply to both of those things very, very easily in anesthesia and in cave diving. You know, if you're well prepared, you're well trained, your equipment is good and checked and tested and the conditions are right, then it should be a very relaxing and pleasant endeavor where, and to be an anesthesiologist, you couldn't do that every day if you're on the edge of your seat, you know, the whole time. When you're at work, you've got to be able to relax and enjoy yourself, obviously. So I find those two disciplines to be very similar, because if it's all going well, then it's actually fun and it's safe and it's relaxing. One is what I do for a living, and one is what I do for my sport. But when it goes bad, it can go bad very, very quickly, and the outcomes can be catastrophic, obviously.
Yeah, in anesthesia, I was partners with a group of neurosurgeons, and they were always kind of talking amongst each other that people will kick their tires when it comes to neurosurgery, and they'll want to really do a checkup on like who this surgeon is that's going to cut me open and work, you know, on my nervous center. And they would never ask about the credentials of the anesthesiologist. And the anesthesiologist, tell me if I have this wrong, is the one that actually puts you the closest to death that you can imagine. And so there's an art and a science, of course, but the art is a little bit of a dance with life and death. Can you shape that up just a little bit for me?
Yeah, that's absolutely true, because all practicing anesthesiologists have passed their examinations. They've done the training in the USA and in Australia and the Western world. You know, the training is very good. It's very robust and comprehensive. But there are still practitioners out there who you would think twice about obtaining their services, and that goes the same for an anaesthetist or a neurosurgeon or your mechanic. You know, they've all got their piece of paper, but there's something that separates the reasonable ones, and I'm not saying whether I'm average or fantastic, but, you know, I believe I'm above a necessary standard to keep people safe, and, you know, most doctors, like most people in whatever part of their life that they work in, they have an appropriate level of skill. And so that's what you want to know, that, you know, you're in the best hands possible, in the reasonable hands. But there's just the odd one who's not quite there, and it's very hard to work out why that is. And I think that is the art side of it. You know, we all know the rules, but there's some nuances that we put into our practice. And, for example, I've seen other doctors, friends of mine, who say, oh, this is the way I do this, and I've tried to do the same, just didn't quite work as well. It just didn't feel like it was as successful. And so there's something that person does that I can't quite detect that they do and makes it successful, whereas in my hands it wasn't. So you find your own way. You find your own little patterns and recipes that work well for you.
So in this dance, you've got science both on both sides of your life efforts, and you've got art, and you're also dancing with, you know, this thin membrane between life and death. And it doesn't necessarily seem that way on a regular basis with cave diving, but it's there. You know, anytime that you're in hostile environments where we're not necessarily or not at all designed to be able to live and survive, meaning underwater or pressured environments, you know, I want to understand your early years. I want to understand how you grew up that led you to have this interest in science, this dance with life and death, and, you know, the thrill and the excitement that comes with the way that you've designed your life. So can you rewind backwards just a bit? And what was it like growing up? Like, and I mean, like what was money for the family like? How many kids did you have? Like really rock solid stuff to just paint the picture of growing up. I don't know if you were wealthy or you came from humble beginnings. I don't have that context.
Yeah, well, I was very lucky. I grew up in a very middle-class family. Dad was a doctor, mum was a nurse. We never had any trouble putting food on the table, lived in a nice suburb. So I was privileged to the point of almost feeling a bit guilty about it, to be honest, because we never struggled. And secondly, we had a very loving family environment. Parents who were very loving took us on nice holidays. I mean, we were wealthy, but I think, you know, growing up, it was always a summer holiday on the beach somewhere local. And Dad had a small boat, and his passion was fishing. And so I grew up on the ocean with my father catching little fish to eat. And very early on, I realised that I was fascinated by the ocean, and I think he instilled that in me. And very early on, I also realised I had a slightly scientific interest in the ocean. I decided I was going to be a marine biologist from a very young age, and I had books and I tried to learn the Latin names of the fish I was seeing, and I did a lot of snorkeling and spearfishing, and similarly tried to learn all about the habits of the creatures that I was slaying with my little hand spear. And it was actually a marine biologist friend of the family who one day lined up these dead fish on the beach for me and asked me if I knew the names of them and what did they eat and so forth. And I realized I didn't know anything about them. I didn't even know whether I could eat them. I was about 10 years old. And she very cleverly pointed out the fact that none of these were edible. And, you know, they sort of, one of them mates for life. And basically, that I was a murderer and I should rethink my strategy. So that was a real light bulb moment for me as a young boy that I remember. And I then, well, firstly, became very selective about what I would spear. So I would only spear stuff that I would eat. But it made me start to look at the fish and the environment and become really even more fascinated with it. Yeah, I grew up as a scuba diver as a teenager, and then at university, the university dive club, became a dive instructor. And that led me to cave diving as a group of people. The instructors decided to go off and give that a try. So I wasn't really looking for adventure. I was just looking for different experiences within that context.
Richard, did you identify as being a cave diver? Was that part of your identity? Or not cave diver, as a diver? When you're a kid, or was it just a thing that you did on the side and it was kind of cool, but you also did A, B, and C other things that were part of your normal activities?
I identified as an ocean person, I think, whether it was boating, fishing, snorkeling, diving, or all of those things, not sailing or boating for them. Mm-hmm. You know, the point of boating, but boating to get me to different parts of the ocean, other catfish or sea fish. And yeah, but it has become a huge part of my identity. As you know, the age of 15, and I'm now 56, so it's been part of my life as long as I can remember.
When I was growing up, I grew up surfing, and so I think once you get bitten by the ocean, there's so many lessons to learn, and there's a depth and a fascination. It's like a never-ending, unfolding learning, you know, environment, and so. When I was in high school, I couldn't wait to get out of high school to get in the ocean. And so did you have that unsettled scratchiness, or was there a different type of discipline in the way that you organized your life?
I'm not sure really. I knew that I wanted to study, keep studying, and I thought marine biology would be the thing. It's actually another friend of mine who was doing marine biology who taught me out of it in the end. He said, no, I can get a job, and it's just a bit hopeless at the moment. So I turned my attention to being a veterinarian. I thought that would be the next best thing, you know, and working with animals and still with that science and biology bent. And also put my name down for medical school, thinking that that would be the next best thing to being a vet. And unfortunately, I missed out on vet school by a couple of marks and got into medical school by a couple of marks. So I was sort of right on the cusp, I guess, of that academic achievement. And that was it. That was my destiny. And to be honest, it's been a fantastic career choice for me. It's been brilliant. I love it.
Destiny. Let's pause there for a moment. It's a big word. It means a lot of different things for different people. Do you map that to a deity and like a spiritual framework, or do you map that in some other way?
Definitely not a religious person. So, no, I don't think it was anything that was ordained or pre-planned. Perhaps destiny was the wrong term for me. But what I would say is that I can't imagine life without medicine now. It's been hugely fulfilling, productive, and also perfect for all my other pursuits and extracurricular activities, because it's allowed me the medicine and the time, especially being an anaesthetist. I'm never sure whether to say anaesthetist or anesthesiologist. I'm talking American, but take it as both meaning the same thing. So
how do you pronounce it?
Anesthetist.
Oh, yeah, we say anesthesiologist.
I know you have nurse anesthetist, but you have anesthesiologist.
Anesthesiology, yeah. Okay, all right.
Being an anesthesiologist gives me one advantage over your neurosurgeon friend is, and that is that when I walk out of the hospital at the end of the day, as long as I've left my patients in good shape, my responsibilities are finished, which means that I can then go away that weekend and have a clear weekend without those responsibilities unless I'm on call. So that has given me the freedom to take time off and go go on expeditions and do stuff that I wouldn't be able to if I was a surgeon, for example. That has actually been a massive and unintended benefit of my choice of specialty.
And then that's cool. I wouldn't have put that together. And then so one feeds the other in time and expertise. I think also anesthesiology allows you to understand deeper, breathing mechanisms, all of the sort of compromised states that might happen on a gurney or in an operating room, but also those same compromised states, you know, with deep water fatigue or shallow water fatigue for folks. So there's probably a blending there that makes some sense too.
Oh, it's been a massive overlap with my interest and studies in diving medicine and the applied physiology that I have to know about to do particularly very deep dives, which have become a bit of a subspecialty for myself and my buddy Craig John. It's kind of a niche interest for us. So there's an enormous amount of physiology, which is very wise to understand to do some of those dives.
Okay, so for folks that are not going to cave dive but want to understand some of the breathing patterns for health and wellness and relaxation and a sense of calm, you know, recovery, there's lots of ways that breathing can help with our physiology, and in particular with the vagus system or the parasympathetic system. What do you think of Tummo breathing? What do you think of long exhales? And is there a precision in long exhales that you found to be valuable for triggering the parasympathetic state?
Well, it's not something I've really studied or practiced, to be honest, Michael. I'm aware of that box breathing where you have equal periods of inspiration, breath hold, expiration, breath hold. And I've used that to help some of the kids that I go bushwalking with. So I work with some charities that work with disadvantaged kids who are struggling a bit. We take them out bush for 8 days in a very remote part of Central Australia, and through that sort of wilderness therapy, help bring them back down a bit and try and sort them out a little bit. So I found that very useful when they're all getting a bit uptight and a bit frenetic. But I don't know if I consciously do that myself, with the exception of when we're actually doing these dives, because part of the strategy to avoid some of these respiratory issues is to keep your work rate down and keep your breathing very regular and very calm. At the moment, you have a problem, of course, at 250 metres underwater in a cave. It's very easy for your heart rate to start coming up, for your breathing to start increasing in speed, and for you to start doing quick and unproductive movements. So we have a sort of a conscious strategy to stop and slow everything down and try and problem solve in a very time-pressured environment where, you know, speeding up is actually very counterproductive on so many levels, both psychologically but also physiologically. And we, Craig and I in particular, talk that through before dives and say, okay, if you get the guideline wrapped around your leg, you know, in 10 metres of water, that would be a very minor issue to sort out. But at that depth, when every minute on the bottom means another 15 or 20 minutes of deep compression time on the way back to the surface, it's a huge clock ticking in your head. You have to just stop and take a breath and relax and solve the problems and be very aware of the speed of what you're doing. It's very hard to go slow when every nerve is screaming to go fast.
Even when you're just describing it right now, you slowed down, you got more quiet, like your physiology, I think you're using imagination right now at some level, and as you're describing it. Is that true? Did you notice that? And is that true that you're using your imagination?
I was picturing myself underwater in that situation, because that scenario has happened to me at that depth. But I wasn't aware of the slowing down, so it's interesting to point that out.
Yeah. And then, well, I think it's a phenomenal thing that when we use our imagination, it changes things for us, and it can freak us out, and it can also prime particular memories and how we engaged. And it can also be an accelerant for our potential and high performance, you know, mental imagery for success, if you will. And then in your preparation to go into compromising, potentially consequential environments, do you do mental imagery, or is it not something that you pay attention to in a disciplined way?
We do pre-visualize our dives a lot. Well, I know I do, and usually in my tent the night before, and spent a week or 10 days setting up the cave, building up to this exploration dive, which we're planning. We usually only do one dive per trip because A, there's a lot of setting up time, and B, it's so mentally and physically exhausting that by the time the dive is done, that's kind of it. You've lost your mojo for any more diving, really, for another period of time. So, yeah, I tend to lie in my tent and think through all the steps of the cave and plan what I'm going to do in each phase and how I'm going to respond to different emergencies. It reminds me a little bit of the film with Alex Honnold, Free Solo, which many of your listeners will have seen, and the way he choreographs every move on the face of that wall in his mind and on paper, in fact. It's an extraordinary performance. I don't think I'm at quite that level, but I certainly try and think through all the steps.
I had him on the podcast after his that adventure, that expedition. And one of the things he talked about, which was an interesting way to, understand his craft, is he says, no, I'm not a risk taker. He goes, I've thought this thing through and I'm highly skilled and I've got all of the capabilities to be able to execute it. But if I make a mistake, it's consequential.
I had the same conversation with him. My podcast, he's a very good podcast topic and a fascinating study for a psychologist, I'm sure. But just as a fellow risk taker, because for me, what he does is absolutely terrifying. And I'm sure for most of us, watching that film was, sitting on the edge of your seat and holding your breath. And I wanted to, and there were all these references or implications that he was somehow on the spectrum or somehow a freak or there was something different about his brain and his amygdala not working on the PET scan that he had. And I wanted to get into that with him, and being Australian, we can be quite rude. So I just asked him, are you autistic? And he said, I wish people wouldn't say that because I really don't think I am. And then he explained to me what you've just said about how he knows what he can do. He's done it every day for the last however many years. He is so confident of his own abilities and limitations that for him that decreases the risk and makes it acceptable because he knows if he goes for this move, he will succeed. And barring a rock coming loose or something that he can't control, he knows he will succeed. And when you put it like that, well, why would you be frightened? So he managed to convince me that he's just a very good athlete, but there's nothing wrong with his brain. He's just very
Okay, I want to talk to you about a new sponsor right here, Hydro. I love what they're doing. They are awesome. I don't know if you're into rowing like I am. I really enjoy it. What I try to do is I try to move around different cardio exercises. Sometimes on a bike, sometimes I'm rowing, sometimes I'm outside. But when I want to row, they've got it dialed in. They've done something fundamentally different than all the other rowers. One, it's not this loud machine that is making a ton of noise. And, chains slapping all over the place. They've done this in a really slick, premium, elevated way. And then the other thing they've done is that there's a nice screen that you can have a guide or a coach with you. And their coaches are Olympians and world-class athletes. And what they've done is they're filming, full stop, they are filming all over the world on places where their experts are rowing, and then you get to go with them. And they're coaching you the whole way. I love it. My favorite coach by far is Mac. She's great. And I just want to encourage you to give them a shot. If you love rowing, I think you're going to love this machine. And if you're not into rowing, I don't know if you know this, but rowing, there's been some research around rowing that rowing engages over 80% of your muscles while you're doing it. So it's a really efficient exercise. This spring, join the growing rowing community at Hydro. Head over to hydro.com and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's hydro.com, hydro.com, and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400. Hydro.com, use the code MASTERY. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AG1. It's really important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost a decade now, I've been drinking AG1. When I first was connected with them, I thought, oh, this is great. This is great. And then I double-clicked to understand their process and how they went about it. And I just love the rigor that goes into what they're creating and the product that they have. And they've gone through so many iterations to get it just right, 52 of them to be exact. Sometimes quality can be a buzzword, but they are committed. They are fundamentally committed to have a great product for us. They're interested in absorption. They're interested in high quality manufacturing. They rigorously test their product. So I trust what's in AG1. And one of the reasons I have extra confidence in that statement is they are NSF certified for sport. That's one of the most rigorous independent quality and safety certification programs in the supplement industry. They've made it so easy as well. What I do every morning is I take a scoop, put it into a cup of water, shake it up, and it's the first thing that I put in my stomach. And I love it. It just gives me the sense like, okay, I've invested in my health and I haven't even started my day yet. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, I want to encourage you to go check out AG1. So try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3, K2, and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/findingmastery. Again, that's drinkag1.com/findingmastery. I hope you go check them out. What major obstacles did you face down as a kid? You know, what were some of the hard things that you had to sort out as a young kid? Because I've read your take on parenting, and you know, you've got a fear, a healthy fear that parents are doing a little too much, and that there's some hardiness that we're going to miss out when we, you know, become Zamboni parents or helicopter parents or like really smooth things out for our kids. And there's a value in allowing our kids or creating the conditions where they get scraped, sometimes even bruised, sometimes even broken bones, dare I say. I can hear the parents right now going, you know, but there's so much to learn from challenge and adversity. And I don't mean something that fundamentally alters their ability to have mobility in life, but what were the obstacles that you experienced as a kid? It can be anything from bullying to broken bones to, you know, whatever.
So I did grow up in this fairly perfect world with a family that I've described. And I couldn't say that I had any major obstacles growing up, certainly no physical disabilities or any particular problems, no family disharmony or violence or anything like that. I think the main challenges I faced were within myself, with a couple of problems. At school, I was very disruptive, very poorly behaved, had a lot of problems with discipline. And I guess that reflected low self-esteem looking back. So I didn't achieve the potential academically or in other endeavors at school that I probably could have. And I don't look back at school as a happy time for me. I really did struggle trying to find my tribe and trying to find my niche. And I think looking back now, I was hanging out with the wrong crowd, you know, trying to fit in with the, you know, the cool kids and the party scene and testing that environment a bit rather than finding perhaps the bushwalking group or the sailing club and those sort of pursuits would have suited me a lot better. But, you know, with the insecurity of a teenager, you want to be one of the cool guys maybe.
Did you feel like an insider or an outsider?
I feel like I had a foot in both camp. Like I was in that group of the cool kids, but I didn't feel like I belonged. And I didn't really like a lot of the values, the social values that were being imparted by those guys, or in fact the school, which was quite a posh private boys' school.
And if you unpack that struggling self-esteem and not quite fitting in but being in the crowd, where did that come from? What was unique about your childhood experiences? Maybe go back a little earlier and say, well, I think it might have been this. And, you know, I'm imagining mom, dad, something like that. But if you unpack that a little bit more, how did that play out?
Yeah, I don't know, because, you know, I feel like I grew up with very strong social conscience, very strong values of being kind to other people and standing up for the underdog. And, you know, with that group of the cool kids, maybe they were, you know, sometimes the ones who were being bullies or picking on some of the weaker kids, and maybe that was causing the inner turmoil for me. Yeah, I didn't realize I was going to get a counseling session here, Michael. This is very, very insightful for me to think back on all this. It's good.
I'm just asking questions, brother. I'm trying to learn.
Oh, thank God we're talking, and I've got so much to tell you.
Oh, my God. All right.
Okay, you won't charge because this, will you?
No. As long as you don't charge. You don't charge me, right?
Really okay.
Yeah, good.
It's a deal.
I think what I'm trying to understand is I want to get to that moment in 2018 where you had a contemplative moment to jump on the plane and go risk your life, knowing that a real risk. And I'm not, this isn't like a make-believe, like, oh, I would go do that too. Like, this is like, whoa, these kids might not come out. So there was a risk of going. Once you entertain something, there's a risk of going and there's a risk of not going. And I'm trying to get all the frameworks I can possibly put in place to understand how you made that decision. This whole conversation is like, how'd you make that decision? And I'm wondering if, let's call it some struggling early self-esteem stuff. Not sure why that showed up with some of the resources that you had, but it was there. Like, what were you trying to sort out by going for it?
I feel like the decision to go to Thailand was the easiest decision I've ever made. I wanted to go there. As soon as I heard those kids were in trouble, I wanted to be there. I wanted to be part of it too, because I knew I had some skills that could be of use. And it was a cracking good adventure. I enjoy performing medicine in strange environments, and I enjoy cave diving. So for me, it was, you know, doing all the things I love. In addition to that, I'd spent the last 10 or 12 years pretty much practicing for this event, unknowing that it would be this particular event. But we've been running cave rescue training in Australia for some time, as have other people around the world. And I had actually generated a course for fellow cave divers to practice bringing someone who might be injured or medically unwell through an underwater section of a cave out to the surface if they had found themselves in strife. And this started in 2008 when I was diving in a very remote cave on the Nullarbor Plain in Western Australia. And the cave's actually 6 kilometres long underwater, but there are two air chambers along the way, one at about 1 kilometre and one at 3.5 kilometres. And each time you reach these air chambers, you have to climb out of the water, carry all your diving gear across basically an underwater mountain of boulders, and then back into the water to continue the exploration. And I was walking through one of these rock chambers one day and realised that if I fell over or injured myself in that space, then who on earth and how on earth was someone going to come and rescue me? If I had a broken femur or pelvis or a head injury, I could see no possible way of escaping that situation. So that's when it dawned on me we needed some kind of capability to rescue people. And that was kind of a purely selfish interest at that point. And so I came back to Adelaide, starting talking to the police divers, to other rescue authorities and other cave divers. And we had this weekend of scenario training. And then from that, I wrote a course, basically, that we've been running pretty much every year since. So I was starting to feel like a fireman who'd never put out a fire, I suppose, because we'd done all this training and I had this equipment and preparedness. And so when a genuine rescue came up, then I was very, very keen to get in.
Okay. That I did not know. And that makes perfect sense that you would be the one. And then mechanically, how does it happen? Like, who pays for your flight? Who pays for that? Is that you saying, I'm a citizen of cave diving and I'm going to go fund this and because I want to be there to make a difference? Or is there some other mechanism at play that I'm not aware of?
No. So any international incident like this, and I learned a lot of this working in the ambulance service in South Australia as a doctor. So any kind of major incident like this, first of all, the country has to invite people. They have to invite volunteers to come and assist. And we learned this from things like the Haiti earthquake, where a large number of American orthopedic surgeons went down there to help fix bones. And of course, in their day practice, all they do is knee arthroscopies or hip replacements, which is not really very much use to a lot of people who have, you know, bones sticking out through their leg and with dust and concrete ground into the legs. They need a wartime trauma approach to their surgery, not elective joint replacement type surgery. So sometimes volunteers are more of a hazard than of a use. So the country needs to invite people, and Australia was invited to contribute. And so we had representatives from our federal police and military on site, as did the US, as did many other countries. And it was one of the British cave divers who first became involved, a guy called Rick Stanton and his dive buddy, John Valanthan. They had been asked to attend because they had a track record of doing other cave rescues. And those guys had been on site for about 4 or 5 days until finally they were the ones who broke into Chamber 9 and found those children. And I knew Rick already from several previous expeditions, so we had a personal relationship. And so I'd been in communication with him throughout. And it was Rick who, in fact, came up with this idea of sedating the children to bring them out. And, of course, when that idea was proffered, he said, "What do you think?" And I said, "Forget it. It's impossible. It's not going to happen." But I reiterated my offer to come over and assist. And so he spoke to the Australian government people on the ground, and then I had a call from the Australian government, and that's how it all started. So from that point on, I was an Australian government employee, and I was sent over there as an Australian government representative, and all the costs were paid by Australia.
Okay, brilliant. All right, so set the scene for folks that are not familiar with this cave dive. And I'd like for you to do it in as abbreviated way as you can, because the story is remarkable. And I want people to learn the story, from you. But I want to get to the stuff about the decisions that you were making. And so I want to leave much of that to it. But I also want to add one thing, is that you were part of an experience where you had to recover the body of one of your friends. So here we are with some of that in your history as you're going to potentially rescue. How many kids was it? Was it 12 or 13?
12 plus the coach.
So it's 13 total, 12 plus the, yeah. Okay, so I'm going to want to know how that set up inside of you, but maybe it didn't. Maybe that was just kind of a distant memory. But okay, so you get the call, you're headed out there, but just set the frame of the conditions that the kids, and I know it was a birthday party. They were going to go do this thing and put their names on the back of a wall. And, like they're just going on a fun expedition with a coach. And it was meant to be a quick little day trip. Ha ha, fun. Let's go do something together. And Mother Nature had different plans. And basically, as I understand it, that there was a hazard flooding. Mother Nature just did its thing. And they got caught in the back of the cave. And so sharpen that up a little bit, but give the main frames of the setting and the conditions.
Yeah, well, this all takes place in a very remote, far northern village of Thailand. It's right on the border with Myanmar. It's a beautiful area, remote rural area, pristine mountains and jungle and so forth. But every year, pretty much at the same time, the monsoon rains start. And when they come, they stick for about 3 or 4 months. There's actually a sign out the front of the cave saying July to November is the cave flooding season. And these boys went in on the 23rd of June. So they, in theory, should have been okay. The weather that day was perfect. There was no sign of any problems. So they went in, and sure enough, it was raining on the other side of the mountain range. And that happened to be the main catchment area for this cave. So they got all the way to the back of the cave, 5 kilometers in. And they turned around to come out, and they found that the passageway was blocked by water, and the water was rising pretty much in front of their eyes. So they tried to, the coach tried to duck dive through the obstruction, nearly drowned himself in the process, came back, and they slept on the beach that first night, woke up the next day to find the water pretty much lapping at their feet. And so they had to retreat further into the cave until they found this very tall, muddy slope with a small flat platform at the top above about 30 feet above the water. And that's where they camped for the next 9 days until they were found.
I mean, how about that? 9 days. So no food.
No food.
Yeah.
No food, just drinking the cave water. And pretty cold, I imagine. It was 23 Celsius. I'll leave you to work that out. So, not cold, but sitting there in damp T-shirt and shorts on the wet mud, you'd lose heat pretty quickly. So very miserable.
Not to mention the fear, not to mention the unknown, not to mention maybe some of the compromised understanding of night and day. I don't know if sun made it to the back of that cave, but there's a dysregulation that takes place if you don't have your circadian rhythm intact. And so was there light in the back of the cave?
No, zero light, pitch dark. And I think they had a watch between them at least. Mm-hmm. And they all had a headlight, which they sensibly conserved and rotated. But by the time they were found, they only had one or two with any power left. So they were being careful to keep the lights out for much of the time. And you're absolutely right. Having slept in caves overnight for a couple of days, you very quickly become disorientated and from a time point of view.
It's quite unhealthy. Yeah, it's really unhealthy. Your brain goes, what have you just done? That's why one of the advents of I think it was the last decade probably, just how powerful it is to get your eyes, because your eyes are one of the gateways. Well, actually, your eyes are the brain, but it's a gateway into deeper regions of your brain. And to get your eyes on first light and your eyes on last light, so sunrise and sunset, is a pretty powerful way to reset your circadian rhythm, you know, to prepare you better for sleep and wakefulness, for efficiencies. And so I'm not saying look right at the sun by any means, but I'm just saying be in the environment for 2 to 15 minutes at first light and at last light. It's a pretty remarkable gift to give your brain.
But also means you got up very early. So you're probably tired.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you're ready. Yeah, right. There's always confounding variables there. Okay, so disorientated, agitated, fearful, hungry, wet, not knowing how to solve it. There was a young kid who tried to. They had a rope, right? And they tied the rope to the kid's waist, I think. And then
That was the coach. Did swim it out on that first evening. And they pulled him back in. He said, "If I feel like I'm going to run out of breath, I'll pull on the rope, and you guys have to haul me back." So that's what they did. So he was very lucky. It was a very tight part of the cave that he was trying to get through. That could have ended very badly.
How old were these kids?
So the youngest was 11, the oldest was 16, and the coach was 25. So pretty young lad himself.
Mm-hmm. And who taught them meditation? Who was meditating with them as a strategy to calm them down?
Yeah, that was really important, actually, because the coach had spent some time as a monk in training, I think, and he was a really interesting character in all of this, very mature 25-year-old. He was essentially a stateless lad from Myanmar. He'd come across the border, as many people do up there, and he had been essentially adopted by that local community. And so he was, very, very calm, sensible guy, and he was instrumental in keeping those boys calm, I think, and helping them to meditate and get through it.
Finding Master is brought to you by Apollo Neuro. By now, you're probably well aware that I am a huge fan of what they're doing. I love what they're building and how they're using science-backed technology to help people flourish. This is just a great technology that isn't measuring something. It's actually providing a state change for you, to help you either downregulate, find a deeper sense of calm, maybe fall asleep a little bit easier. And if you want to be a bit more up and animated, they've got a way to help you do that as well. It's awesome. It works by sending silent, soothing vibrations. They call them Apollo vibes, of course. That's fun. And it's like music that you can just feel. Just like music, higher vibrations help improve your energy and focus, while lower vibrations, slower vibrations, help to reduce stress, help you relax. I use it twice a day. I use it after I do something really intense. So after it's a lift, after some fitness, after some sport, or after something I'm doing in the office. And I use it right before I go to bed. The science that they've found is fascinating. Across various real world and clinical trials, Apollo wearable users experience up to 40% less stress and feelings of anxiety. That's an average, of course. 19% more time in deep sleep, 11% increase in HRV, heart rate variability, and up to 25% more focus and concentration. Those are radical. And because you're a part of the Finding Mastery community, you're going to get an exclusive, and I mean that word here, 15% off an Apollo wearable. So just head to apolloneuro.com/findingmastery and use the code findingmastery at checkout. This is an exclusive offer only available to Finding Mastery. I love that we get to do this together. So be sure to use our code. Again, APOLLONEURO, apolloneuro.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout for 15% off your purchase. You're only getting that here. I really hope you'll check them out. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AquaTrue. We all know how important hydration is to performance and recovery and well-being, but it's not just about how much you drink. The quality of your water plays a big role. And if you're like me and you don't fully trust tap water, and I think for good reason, research by the Environmental Working Group has shown that 3 out of 4 homes in the U.S. have harmful contaminants in tap water. That's why I'm really excited to introduce AquaTrue. Their purifiers use a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters. It's incredible. I can literally taste the difference in my water. Plus, the filters are affordable and long-lasting. Just one set of filters from their classic purifier makes the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water. That adds up to less than 3 cents per bottle. It feels great to know that all at once, I'm saving money, getting the highest quality water for the Finding Mastery team, and helping make a positive impact on the environment by eliminating single-use plastics all the way around. AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and it even makes a great gift. And right now, because you're a Finding Mastery listener, you receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. So just go to aquatrue.com. You spell it AQUATRU.com and enter the code Finding Mastery at checkout. Again, that's aquatrue.com. Enter the Finding Mastery code at checkout to receive 20% off any purifier that you buy there. Okay, so you arrive at the scene and you're in a remote area. It's raining and you're assessing like, how am I going to do this? How do you filter that? How do you make sense of that? Knowing that there's lives on the line and you've got to work quickly. Yeah, you've got to take care of your safety. And you've also got to be incredibly accurate because I imagine that as you're assessing it, it's probably not an easy swim for you. But I don't know that. I don't know the conditions. But I have been in those situations like, oh, I'm barely doing this. How am I going to help the other?
Well, exactly. Yeah. And the other thing is, you know, arriving on site, you know, you're immersed in chaos. And I've learned this through my work with the ambulance service. You arrive at a big car accident scene and it's night and it's raining and there's flashing lights everywhere. It's very disorientating. You know, there's the firemen, there's the police, there's the ambulance people, and it just, it's a shock, you know, when you jump out of that helicopter or get out of the car to at that scene. Well, that's what I felt like when we arrived on site at Thailand. There were people everywhere and they're all wearing different uniforms. They're up to their knees in mud. It's raining. The media is enormous in its presence. You know, we've got all these cameras poked in our faces. Who are these people from Australia? What are they going to contribute?
Are you welcomed?
No, we had a local fixer, a Thai guy who worked for the Australian embassy, who was shepherding us through all this. But it was still very chaotic, in a sense, and overwhelming. So my first feeling was I need to find Rick and John, the British divers, and just talk to them to ground myself and to get some information about the cave. Because as you rightly pointed out, my first priority was to my own safety. I have to make sure that I can safely traverse this cave to where the kids are. And I remember Rick saying, oh, Harry, you know, the cave, it's a bit sporting, but I think you'll be all right. I mean, that's like Edmund Hillary telling you that it's just a bit of a jog to the top of the hill. You know, I mean, these guys are so good. They are really,
these are legends.
Rock stars.
These guys are like world-class legends.
These guys are the best, yeah. And for Rick and John to swim through this cave and say it's not too bad, really, I had to find out for myself, because if I can't get myself to the end of the cave and home safely, then there's nothing I can do for these children. So initially there was quite a lot of pressure on me to just go in the next day and start anesthetizing these children.
Okay, wait. I want to go to the pressure piece for a minute. What does that mean? There was a lot of pressure on me.
Well, you know, Rick and John, and by then two other British cave divers had arrived. They were working with the Thai Navy SEALs. They were working with some other expat cave divers on the scene, and they were working closely with the local government. And this plan to anesthetize the children and bring them out unconscious had started to really take hold, despite the fact that I'd told Rick that I thought it was preposterous and impossible.
But you brought your medicine.
No, I didn't bring any medicine, but I brought a plan in my head. Okay. But, you know, mm-hmm. you don't really jump on a plane and fly to Thailand with a bag full of scheduled drugs. So it's not a, that okay. doesn't end well for quite a few Australian tourists who have done the same thing. It's they're still
okay.
there.
Yeah, they're right. They didn't come back. Okay, good. No. All right.
So no, I wasn't going to do that. But, you know, I knew I had the whole Thai Army Medical Corps at my disposal if I – you know, to get me what I needed. And I'd actually sent a recipe list, you know, a whole list of medications, which I had toyed with the idea of using. So I'd sent that ahead so that everything would be in place should we go down this path. But I was a long way from being convinced that this was the best option. And furthermore, since I was the guy who would be wielding the syringe, I had to make sure that it was the only option before I was going to go anywhere near it. Because for several reasons, I was convinced that this would result in the death of every single one of those children. So I wasn't embarking on that lightly.
Right. So this is you're in true expedition in a different way. You're not trying to summon something. You're trying to save something, someone. Was this your training that was leading you to that that decision, or was this an intuition that you had that there was some sort of psychology involved, some sort of human behavior that was involved, that putting a needle in these young compromised humans is going to be far more dangerous than trying to relax them to swim for a long period of time underwater or be dragged, however it goes?
Well, I guess this was equal parts the science and the art that we were talking about before. On a scientific level, there were several major concerns that I had about whether this could possibly work. And some of those had been validated in the training that we'd done, the scenarios that we'd run. For example, on one occasion, I was wondering whether it would be possible to bring out an unconscious caver underwater. And so I modeled that by pretending to be unconscious, put a full face mask on so that I didn't have to hold a regulator in my mouth. I could just breathe in and out of the mask, and got people to drag me around underwater on a stretcher. And very quickly, I found that incrementally, a little bit of water started to enter the mask. And unless I took active steps to clear that, then inevitably I felt I would have drowned. So based on that and several other sort of physiological principles around anesthesia and diving, I could just see all these little holes opening up that would inevitably kill these kids. The second thing was, this was completely unprecedented. No one has ever been anesthetized and immersed, with the exception of one person, Edgar Pask, who was a British physiologist who was working in the Second World War. And I'd learned about Edgar Pask during my anesthesia training because he invented a piece of equipment that we use. But the way he invented it was that he wanted to test the Mae West life jackets that the pilots were using in the English Channel. And the idea was they needed to know for sure whether the life jacket would keep the airman's head out of the water if the airman was unconscious. And so he'd got some people to float around in a pool and feign unconsciousness, but he couldn't be convinced that they were really being unconscious and properly floppy. And maybe they were righting themselves at the last moment. So he had himself anesthetized, intubated, and put in the pool with the life jacket, and thus proved that the life jackets do work. So that is physiology and science in its most heroic form to me. In fact, he ended up in hospital with a fair bit of pool water in his lungs, apparently, but he did prove the point that this would work. And he then anesthetized a bunch of other airmen, volunteers, to do the same thing. So he's always been one of my heroes. And in fact, I received the Edgar Pask citation from the Association of Anaesthetists of Great Britain and Ireland after Thailand, which is actually the most beautiful award I received, really, after all this. It was really gratifying. So anyway, we digress. So Edgar's the only bloke who's tried this before, and I was going to be the next guy. And you know, the stakes were quite a bit higher. It wasn't a clear swimming pool. It was 2.5 kilometers of flooded cave passage in a dive that was going to take 3 hours. Now, you don't have to be an anaesthetist or a cave diver to conceive that if you render someone unconscious and then push them underwater, unable to observe or monitor them really in any way for 3 hours, they're not going to be alive when you bring them out the other end. So that's what I was faced with, and I was dead against the idea, I can tell you.
Whew. Okay. And then how did you in that moment feel pressure?
Well, it was intense. At the pressure from the British and other divers to carry on and perform this meant that I had to stand up and basically say, no, I'm not doing it. I need 24 hours to A, dive the cave myself, visit the children and see the environment that they're in, with a view to looking at it as my operating theatre. How am I? Is there a place that I can do this? Is there a suitable, you know, is it possible? And thirdly, to look at the children themselves. You know, were they panicking? Were they calm? What physical state were they in? Were they all sick with chest infections or diarrhea? You know, what sort of patients would they be from a purely medical point of view? And until I'd done that, I couldn't even conceptualize going to the next step and performing the anesthesia. But equally important, I had to make sure I was safe in that environment. So I asked them for 24 hours. So I had to review all the other plans that were in place, the water pumping efforts, finding other entrances, the idea perhaps that we could provision the kids with food and just keep them in there for the duration of the monsoon season. All these other ideas, I had to be sure that none of those things could possibly work before I was going to embark on a plan that I felt had 100% chance of failure.
Okay, so you're really calm as a human. You're even keeled. Is that your nature, or did you train to have this interface with life?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that because I suffer from anxieties like anyone, and there are some things that frighten me, and there are some places or scenarios where I find I can at least exude calm. And I think in critical care medicine, that can be a learnt behavior, and it's very important behavior, because if you're leading a team in a resuscitation, for example, and you're panicking outwardly, then it's very hard to get people to be coherent and follow and stick to the plan.
And does your pressure and or anxiety come from, or is it experienced from a thought loops? You know, like, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know, like, what if, like thought loops? Or is it more physiological where you recognize that your hands tremor just a little bit, your heart rate comes up? Is it a combination of both, somatic or cognitive anxiousness?
Yeah, definitely both. When I feel anxious, I definitely get both, and probably I think sometimes it's pathological, my anxiety, but it tends to be from things that aren't important. It tends to be from, you know, social anxiety or public speaking or things that actually don't have a significant outcome apart from myself, you know, how I look or appear. And so that probably, again, goes back to that insecurity of my own self rather than, you know, genuinely difficult situations when I tend to actually feel better and step up perhaps.
With all of your capabilities and all the extraordinary experiences you've had and the success you've had, what is it about other people's opinions that is scary?
It's a good point. I think I do worry a lot about what other people think of me. And the older I get, the less important that becomes to me. I think that's a natural part of aging. But as a teenager and man in my 20s, I'd say I had a very thin skin. I was easily wounded by words and opinions. Whereas as I get older, I care less. And I guess, you know, it's easier to care less when you've had some recognition for doing something, which Thailand, you know, that was one of the outcomes, I guess, is that suddenly, you know, we're in the media in Australia and we're getting the recognition and awards and people are telling us that we're wonderful blokes all of a sudden. And I'd never, ever had that in my life. You know, I was always terrible at sports and, you know, just did my own thing. But, you know, I didn't have a shelf full of trophies and medals behind me. So, you know, whilst I didn't go out looking for recognition or reward, I think it's been good for my self-esteem, certainly.
Mm. It's super interesting because most of the time it becomes a hollow endeavor, meaning that you're craving the knowing that you're okay, and then somebody gives you some evidence that you are okay. But now there's a little bit of a snake eating its tail, is that somebody else gave it to you rather than you being and knowing that you're okay because you breathe. You're okay because you matter just because you are alive. And so there's this external validation that becomes a bit of a trap. And it doesn't feel like you got caught in that snare.
No, I think, again, that's part of being a bit older and more mature. If this happened in my 20s, then I might have gone to my head. And, you know, you see young people, say, you know, a pop star who suddenly gets a gold record and, you know, life can go off the rails pretty much because suddenly they've got fame, money and fake friends all around them. I think when you're in your 50s, it's a lot easier to see through those traps and you know already who your proper friends are and you don't really care about opinions so much. But that's taken a long time for me to develop, I think.
Looking back to your 20-year-old self, in context of what we're describing right now, what would you offer as guidance to your 20-year-old self that has that fear of other people's opinions, that is still trying to figure out, how do I belong? Where do I fit in? What is my role? You know, am I okay? What would you offer as some guidance?
Well, I would offer what I'm telling young people that I talk to now. I readily give them the insights that I've given you about how shaky I was at their age, and that I was very lucky to find a single passion in life, which was the ocean and scuba diving. And if any of you are lucky enough to have a passion, however, you know, kind of unusual or potentially useless in terms of a career or furthering your life, it appears you're incredibly lucky if you just have one thing that you're passionate about, and you should absolutely pursue it because you never know where it will lead. So, you know, I encourage young people to cling to one little thing that they're good at or that they love and build a base from that. And I think the scuba diving turned out to be very, very important in my life for that reason.
Mm. Okay, cool. All right. Back to the cave.
Mm.
So you go on a scout expedition, and as you're going through to the back of the cave, were there moments where you're like, ooh, I don't know how are we possibly going to get these kids through here? Or did it be like, were you navigating like, oh, okay, I can see how we're going to move through here, this section, that section. And, or was it, you know, something that was way more complicated than I can even imagine?
Yeah, the cave itself was challenging, as Rick had suggested, but it wasn't the worst cave dive we'd ever done. I mean, we would never dive in an actively flooding cave by choice because there are extra hazards there. You know, if a flood pulse comes through, then it's quite a dangerous place to be. Because the cave was flushing out, it was the water was like coffee color. It was zero visibility. You couldn't see your hand in front of your face. And there were some very tight and difficult restrictions. And the cave line that Rick and John had placed in the cave for us all to follow and safely navigate in and out, which is essential, hadn't been perfectly placed because it was placed in an emergency, not in clear water with all the time in the world. So there were some difficult places to navigate. So all of that was in my mind, that this is a difficult cave, but the overwhelming concern was that it was the duration of the dive rather than the complexity of the dive that was the big hazard for these children. You know, 3 hours underwater, doesn't matter whether it's in a swimming pool or in a difficult cave, they're just not going to survive that period of time. And I knew that we had the best cave divers in the world there to help navigate these kids. So if anyone could, they would get them through this particular cave. But that wouldn't help the fact that they were being immersed for that period of time in an unconscious state.
When you finally get back there and you see the kids, what happens?
Well, that was a very memorable moment, as you can imagine. Until then, it had all been really hypothetical. I'd had well over a week to contemplate this moment. And I remember as I approached the surface and I could see that sort of mirror-like shimmer on the surface, the water in that section was relatively clear. And I thought, this is it. I'm about to actually look these kids in the eye. Now, by then, 4 Thai Navy SEALs were camped in with the kids. And so we're very lucky that one of them was a doctor, sort of very highly overachieving fellow who was a special forces in the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force paratrooper, I think, and a medical practitioner who was amazing guy. And he spoke some English, so he was able to interpret and explain to me how the kids were doing and so forth. And the kids actually looked incredible. They were all walking, talking, smiling. They just looked like a bunch of teenagers on a camp in a cave. You know, there was relatively little sign that they were facing almost certain death. And I was immediately impressed by the courage and resilience of these kids, who remain for me the greatest heroes in this story. There's no doubt that if they didn't have that demeanor, it would have been very, very difficult to deal with them. In fact, a really important point for me was, there's no way I was going to drag a child kicking and screaming down to the water and assault them and anesthetize them. They had to be willing participants in this if it was going to happen at all. So I was very pleased to see that they were cooperative and looking in pretty good shape, I have to say.
Okay. So you come up and you've got this grin on your face and you're like, okay, this doesn't look so bad. And then next, how do you mobilize to the rescue?
Well, the first thing I tried to do, obviously, in terms of the children, was to put on a persona of someone that is having the best time of their life. What a great day. Here we are. We're in the back of the cave. What a great adventure. Yeah, sure, we're going to anesthetize you and bring you out of the cave. What could possibly be simpler? I think that's a really important skill for a medical practitioner or a rescuer, to portray confidence and relaxed demeanor. Because if you look like you're shaking your head going, we're okay, we're all buggered, there's no way, then the kids are more likely to panic. So I did work very hard on presenting a confident face to them. But I was really not impressed with what I was seeing in terms of, you know, what I'd seen on the way through, with the lack of visibility in the water, the muddy, very toxic environment that they were in. I mean, the smell was overpowering. Obviously, they'd been in there for 12 days, I think, by now, and doing their business. They'd had food taken into them, with the inevitable result. So it was pretty awful in there by then. But that helped me realize that to leave them in there was going to be unsurvivable. They would rapidly succumb to infection. I could hear a couple of them already coughing, and it was only a matter of time before they developed gastroenteritis and started to deteriorate pretty rapidly. So I realized then they had to come out. There was no way we could leave them in there. They would have died a very slow and awful death. And that was the point where I realized that we were just going to have to give this a try, because to leave them would condemn them to death, but in a much more dreadful fashion than what I was offering. So in the end, you know, people keep saying to me, if you genuinely believe that it would 100% fail, what you were proposing, why or how could you possibly have entertain that? And to me, the decision became very binary. It was either leave them to die a very slow, awful death from starvation, exposure, or infection, let alone the psychological terror that would impart upon them, or you take them out and probably they'll die, but they'll be anesthetized and asleep when that happens. So essentially euthanizing them. And, you know, I think there's a very pragmatic answer to that question, one or the other. And for me, the answer was simple. We had to give this a try. And if they died, at least they wouldn't know anything about it. It wouldn't be good for me, but it's a better option for them. So that kind of made it simple. And once I made the decision, then I went with it, and I started to believe that it had to work.
Beautiful dilemma that you're setting up between two unfavorable conditions, one better than the other, and the consequence is obviously life and potential torture for you. And at what point did you wrestle with at all imposter syndrome?
Well, you know, for the first time in my life, perhaps I actually believed I was the right man for that job.
Okay.
You know, I had years of working in medicine in difficult, remote, unusual environments, expedition medicine, working in the Pacific Islands for 2 years, you know, with very rudimentary equipment and assistance, and, you know, holding a torch for the surgeon into the abdomen, that kind of experience. I mean, that gives you some experiential credibility, I guess, if that's a word, to have faith in yourself in some situations. You know, working at a car crash at night in the rain in a ditch in the mud, delivering critical care medicine in those environments, you realize that you're either proficient or comfortable in those environments. The cave diving itself wasn't a barrier to me. It's what we do on the weekends. It's what we do for fun and pleasure. And I think that's something that I have to emphasize to people when I'm talking to them, because for most people, their phobias are around the cave and the cave diving. And you have to just eliminate that from the equation, because that's what we love doing, you know. So that was fine. So I was able to put these kids into that workbox. You know, this is my next patient. I just have to do my best for them and send them on their way with the British diver who's going to be taking them out through the cave once I've anesthetized them.
Mm. Okay. And do you have a sense that your ability to be a leader in that moment was something that you had also trained for? And it doesn't sound like it. It sounds like you're comfortable in that position, but now you're thrusted as all lights on you for next calls. But maybe that's something that feels very familiar to you.
I think it does feel familiar in both the expedition space and the medical space. You know, it's different times in medicine. You have to be a team leader.
That's right.
And I enjoy working in small teams of like-minded, competent people, and that's exactly where I found myself.
If you were put on the spot, like on a podcast right now with me, what are the characteristics of leadership that you would say if there was just three? I hate to be a reductionist, but if there's like, hey, listen, like here, this is what a leader means.
I don't know if I'll be able to find three, but I think the important thing to me is the ability to make a decision. You need to look at an impossible decision sometimes, and you have to choose, because to not decide is to be paralyzed and nothing will happen, and certainly nothing good will happen. So, you know, in anesthesia, where, you know, the old adage about 3 minutes without oxygen, 3 days without water and so forth. Well, we work in the 3 minute department. And so you have to make quick decisions sometimes when suddenly there's a problem and the patient has 3 minutes before you start to hurt them or hurt their brain. So you can't be paralyzed with fear. You have to move forwards, always move forwards. Mm. And that comes from being well prepared and having plan A, B, C, D, and E in your mind, and sometimes even vocalized before you start to the rest of the team members. So good communication, preemptive communication, and ability to make a decision, even though it might be a bad one. But the alternative is even worse.
So you get in and you're in the cave, you have an aha moment. And with that aha moment, how do you get to the first kid? You say, right, Joey, you're up. Or do you say, who would like to be the first one to go?
Yeah, well, we didn't start the rescue that day. We went away and came back the next day because the Thais had to sign off on the plan yet. And so that was a late night, very long meeting that night. But what I did say to the doctor, the Thai doctor in there, is tomorrow we hope to come back and start doing this anesthetic plan. And I had a dot point recipe written out in Thai for me by the doctors on the surface to give to the Thai doctor to read out to the kids. And it basically said, tomorrow we'll come back. You'll be dressed in wetsuits. You're going to receive a tablet, which was alprazolam, a benzodiazepine sedative, just to make you feel relaxed. Then you're going to come down to the water, sit on my lap. You're going to get an injection in each leg, and then you're going to go to sleep. We're going to finish dressing you in diving equipment, take you out of the cave, and when you wake up, you'll be out of the cave in the hospital. So the Thai doctor, Dr. Puck, amazing guy, he's halfway through reading this through to himself, and he sort of gives me this sideways look as if to say, are you completely mad? You know, I can't believe I'm about to read this out to the children. But being a very professional guy, he sort of looked back to his paper, and then he read it out to the kids, and I was just watching the children's faces. And to a boy, they were just like nodding, yep, no worries, thumbs up. It was like it was the most normal, natural thing in the world that was being proposed. But I think, you know, by that stage, I could have told them we were going to take them out on a flying carpet, and they were just ready to leave. They would have done anything to get out of that place.
Yeah. So here's the adult in the room. He's a doctor, and he's saying this is the right thing to do. And so we're going to do it.
I think so. And in Thailand, they still respect their elders over there. So, you know, people in a position of authority are to be listened to and respected in Thailand, which is quite convenient for this situation.
Oh, golly. Okay. So first kid up, and you're preparing the patient, if you will, and you're cleaning, you're giving him the benzo, you're cleaning the legs, and you give the injection.
No cleaning of the legs. We're sitting in mud. He's wearing a wetsuit. I just stab it through the neoprene wetsuit into his thigh. This is not clinical anesthesia as we know it, Jim.
No, it's not. Take me to that moment. Do you look at the child in the face? Are you rushing? What is your state in that moment with this child?
I do quite a bit of pediatric anesthesia, and I have a little patter that I talk to the kids as they're being anesthetized. Often we're giving them a mask.
Richard, I'm starting to get Richard, like I'm starting to get nauseated. You are so perfect for this gig. Like, it's unbelievable. You know, like each time I'm like, okay, and this, and you're like, yeah, I've got a framework there, and I've got a reference point here, and I've got a reference point there.
Well,
you really were the one. You know, like it's remarkable, but this in itself is like remarkable. But for you to be able to cobble all of these experiences together, have all of these reference points, and to be able to execute against them. Okay, I want to pause right now. Like, how do you think about life's design?
Yeah, don't ask for any deep and spiritual answers from me, Michael, because I'm a man of science, you know
that's coming.
You know, sometimes it's like the Swiss cheese model of accident analysis. You know, sometimes the holes in the cheese line up, the arrow goes through, and the O-ring on the space shuttle gets cooked and the thing blows up, right? Well, this was the reverse. This was the Swiss cheese accident analysis of good outcomes. When all the cheese lined up, the arrow came through and hit me right in the chest, and there I was. I was the guy, and I just had the right set of skills.
All right. Go back to the kid in the cave. And so you're looking at him, and you've got a needle in your hand. Is the thumb on, like the kind of classic, you know, thumb, or is it in your palm of your hand?
It's this sort of thing, but it's going down into the leg. So I'm just chatting to the kid and trying to make him comfortable. He doesn't speak English. I don't speak Thai. The doctor is right there doing a little bit of interpreting. So I'm asking his name, where does he play on the soccer team, all that sort of stuff, just trying to have a bit of banter. And then I hold up the syringe and tap his leg so he knows it's coming, and in it goes. And look, it's uncomfortable for them. It's going through the wetsuit, which doesn't do anything for the sharpness of the needle, I'm sure. So it's probably painful, and it's quite a big volume of ketamine going in. And takes about 4 or 5 minutes, and they're asleep in my arms, which is unusual because I'm in water up to my waist. I've got a knee sort of cocked up in the mud to try and keep them from falling into the water. And suddenly you've got this rag doll on your lap, and you're trying to, with the assistance of the British divers, to dress them in the rest of the diving gear, which was unexpectedly difficult. You know, to put a mask on someone and make sure it's all secure and safe.
As I'm listening, I don't know what's happening, but I'm flooded with emotion. I think I'm maybe thinking about my son, and like it's right behind my eyes where I'm like, it's in my throat where I'm feeling the fatherly nature. Do you feel that too?
Well,
sometimes?
I certainly felt a very strong connection with these boys at that time. I don't think I was not specifically thinking of my own children, but thinking very much about the fact that these boys are going to start this dive alive, and that their dead bodies are coming out the end of the cave almost certainly. And basically, I felt like I was euthanizing them at that point. It was very, very confronting.
What happens right now to you as you tell this story? Do you feel at all what I'm feeling?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
In this moment?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can't tell this story, and I've told it many, many times now, but I can't tell this story without that emotion. Mm-hmm. It's still very real. And I'll tell you, there were two things that I did after that, which were in some ways the lowest points of my medical career or my sense of humanity. was that the first thing I had to do once the mask was on was push their face into the water whether water would enter the mask or not. And I did that about three times and then held them back up after about 30 seconds to check the mask. And I will remember till the day I die the first time I did that on the first boy, you know, that sense that I'm now drowning. That was difficult. The second thing we did was we decided to restrain the boys' hands behind their back and tie their ankles together because we didn't want their arms floating out and getting caught up or injured in the cave with all the stalactites and projections. But also, if the child woke up halfway, you know, through a difficult underwater section, their first response would be to reach up and either rip their own mask off or disable the British diver who would be taking them out. And that would mean certain death for both of them, probably. So that act of having the boy lying face down in the water and clipping his hands together behind his back with cable ties and a carabiner, you know, that was very symbolic as well for me of the, you know, the appalling level that I'd stooped to in terms of what I was doing to these kids. It just felt, you know, went against everything that I'd been trained and believed in.
Whew. I mean, your whole history was saying yes and no at the same time.
Mm.
Yes and no, right? The idea of handcuffs and the constraints and the lack of dignity that the choice that was being like, no, yes, this is the best plan. And yes, I'm fit to do this job.
Yeah, I had to push through that, I have to say.
Yep. How did you do that? Because it's that type of ambiguity, nimbleness, competing ideas that I think is at the center of leadership as well to make decisions. But there's competing information, there's ambiguity about the outcome, and there's both science and intuition embedded in here. And you're brand new. You are brand new at this.
Mm.
So how did you navigate that? Did you shove down the emotion? Did you recognize the emotion? Did you want to panic but say, hold on, keep your shit together? Come on, you got this. This is what we agreed on. Like, how did you do that?
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't feel close to panic, but the gravitas mm-hmm. didn't escape me. You know, I recognized that this was a pivotal moment in my life, and I had agreed to do it, and I wasn't going to turn away from it. But I knew how impactful it was at that moment. And the same for the four British guys who were with me, you know, observing this. And we were talking out loud. I usually talk out loud when I'm doing something in medicine that is difficult or I need to share with the team. So I was probably verbalizing what I was thinking. And, it was tough. But isn't it incredible how the most appalling things in the world can become familiar and even routine? Because I can tell you in 3 days' time, when I was doing the last child, that this was becoming a familiar and almost interesting thing to observe. Like, I was starting to make observations about physiological changes in the kids as I was pushing their faces in the water you know, commenting again on some academic stuff to the British divers rather than the horror of this moment. So, you know, we really are very good at adapting and normalizing what should be never normalized, I think.
Mm. Normalizing what should never. This association that you're describing is maybe one of the reasons why people aren't. Well, there's lots of reasons PTSD happens or post-traumatic stress, right? There's a disassociation that takes place to try to make sense of it.
Mm.
But this association, that part, those regions of your brain where you're associating, creating new reference points, accessing a logical, sequential type of patterning, probably was one of the things that was a buffer to be able to work through it. Yeah. Okay. And then what were the other boys doing when you were watching, when they were they watching their friends pass out in your arms and then be handcuffed?
Well, I'm not really sure because they were 30 feet up the slope and we'd asked the Thai doctor and the other Thais to keep them around the corner out of view so they didn't watch. But I would be pretty confident if I was a 15-year-old boy in there, I'd be having a pretty good look at what was happening to my mates down the hill. So I'm sure they were watching at some point.
Yeah.
But again, you know, when I came back on the second day and I was thankfully able to tell the boys that all their four friends were alive and well in hospital, then, you know, they're, you know, who's next? And every hand shot up sort of thing. They were keen to go.
Get me out of here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Based on this experience that you've had, what have you come to understand about the psychology of being human?
What have I learned? Well, I mean, we are capable of so much more than we think we are. There's no doubt. And you see that every time someone runs a marathon for the first time, I'm sure they didn't get out of bed when they started their jogging career and thinking, I'll be able to run a marathon. I do keep coming back to this thing. You've just got to put one foot in front of another and you never know how far you can go and what you can finally achieve. And I am a bit obsessive compulsive in terms of when I take something on, I will see it through to the nth degree. I will learn everything about it. If I start a podcast, I will become a podcast expert and research all the audio equipment and, you know, try and be the best podcaster I can possibly be. That's just the way I roll. If I start a project, you know, get out of the way because I'm coming through. I'm going to be the world champion by the time I finish. And then I'll probably discard it and move on and try something else. So I tend to, you know, operate that way. And so I think we have great potential and we can achieve things if we decide we want to. And if, of course, we have the resources to enable us, you know, you have to have food on the table and a roof over your health, over your head. But, you know, given those basics, it's unimaginable what we can achieve as individuals. So I don't know if that even remotely answers your question, but that's the way I feel.
I've asked that question a bunch, and one of my friends, he's a he was a commander for Navy SEALs, Team 5, and Master Chief, and he says exactly what you just said. He says two things. He says, when something matters to you, you'll do whatever it takes. And how does he put it? As a species, we are not even scratching the surface of what we're capable of.
Yeah, I'd agree.
So, that message keeps coming through over and over again. So I want to honor your time and I just want a quick hit on how do you think about mastery? Like the defining of it, the characteristics of it, wherever you want to go with it.
Yeah, so I ask myself, have I ever truly mastered anything? And I quite like, and you've probably heard this from many of your guests, the Maslow's steps about, you know, reaching that point of unconscious competence where you don't even have to think about what you're doing and you're doing it very, very well at a very high level. And I think I've achieved that in the sphere of anesthesiology. In my routine practice, I go to work, I can be very comfortable and assured that my patients are going to go to sleep and wake up safely and have good outcomes. But there's always the challenges that come from left field. And when those moments occur, that 1% terror, which I started out by talking about with cave diving and anesthesiology, that's when sometimes that's when you know whether you've mastered it or not, whether you resolve that situation quietly, confidently and efficiently, or whether you if the cracks start to open in what you're doing. And I think there's a level of difficulty that can pop up, which will test all of us and prove to us actually maybe we never fully have mastered this thing that we think we're good at. So you always have to be on your guard. You always need to look for the traps. And whether it's in cave diving or anesthesia, when the outcomes can be very significant in terms of life and death, then you can never relax and assume you've reached that level of mastery. So mastery is about keeping your eyes open and watching out, because you never know when it's going to come and bite you in the ass.
And are there a couple of habits that you have found to be paramount for you on your commitment to mastery? Things that you do on a regular basis that support your adventure in life?
Well, I've got routines, maybe rituals, if you like. In both disciplines, it's about checking and checklists. And I don't tend to use written But I certainly have mental checklists, which are very brief, very robust, and tick off the very important things. And I use those every single time I jump in the water or commence an anesthetic. So,
and how long is the checklist? Is it like three, four, five things?
60
is
seconds. 60 seconds. Yeah, 60. On my anesthetic machine, you know, there's 60 seconds of checks, which will make sure that this machine has all the important life support functions. And in my diving, it's the same thing. But, you know, it is a bit long.
Checking your nozzles, your gauges, your this, that, and the other. So it's mechanical? Yes. And is there anything psychological
as well? Physical hands-on. Physical hands-on touching things, turning knobs, testing equipment to make sure it's all there where it's supposed to be when I need it.
Do you sleep well?
Usually. Not always, but mostly sleep very well.
Yep. Mostly.
I sleep with a clear conscience. I sleep with a clear conscience, Michael.
I bet you do. I bet you do. Hey, I'm going to remember that. I actually do too. You know, there's a lot of freedom in that. And, you know, I've got this understanding that I want to live in alignment with my virtues and my values, right? My first principles, if you will. And they're not mine until I've had to pay for them. Yeah. And so, you know, you can talk about living a life of honesty, let's say, but it's not yours until you've been challenged, until you have to, in some respects, pay dues to be honest. Otherwise, it's just easy. You know, you know, right? It's not really yours. It's just something you've kind of made up that is aspirational. Okay. Doc, thank you.
Well, you've got a lot out of me that I that I wasn't planning to share, Michael. So you're a crafty bastard, as we say in Australia.
Oh, God. Hey, listen, I love the Australian ethos. I've got a lot of friends that are living there. And I love the ethos. I love the culture, you know, the tall poppy kind of bloke approach to life. And I appreciate, in that in mind, I appreciate where you've gone and the life you've lived and also expressed in this conversation. So I just want to say thank you and let's get people to your podcast. What's the website that we can drive people to or social media?
Just Google Real Risk. Basically
Real Risk.
Interviewing risk takers to find out that in fact, they're not all mad. They're all very careful, methodical, pragmatic people who have, you know, developed their skills to keep themselves safe and enjoy their sports. Which is what I sort of, that was my hypothesis. Are they crazy? Was Alex Honnold crazy? Or is he just really good at what he does? And I think I'm finding the answer in the latter.
And I found from working with some of these folks as well that they actually have a bit of an aversion, the ones that last, a bit of an aversion to, let's call it risk, but adrenaline and risk.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like, yeah, that's not part of the sequence. This is not this thrill-seeking gene that we once thought was around.
No.
There's an incredible amount of control. And so would you categorize yourself as a risk manager or risk taker?
Absolutely, a risk manager. Yeah. If my heart rates up or I'm frightened, then I'm doing something wrong.
But you took a risk to get on the flight and to go try something that's never been done before with other people's lives in your hands. There's risk involved in that. And so that's where there's like the first primer, I'm going to take a risk. And then once I'm in the amphitheater of risk, I think that we manage. And so that would be my hypothesis there, or my thesis.
Yeah. Well, it was a risk that had to be taken. And I never felt physically in danger for myself.
That's right.
And perhaps I was naive, but my wife was quick to point out how it could have been a career and a psychologically life-ending event for me had any of those children died, let alone all of them. You know, social media, the main press would have been pretty quick to point out that I was now called the Dr. Death of Thailand or some similar pseudonym had it all gone pear-shaped. So, you know, I'm kind of cynical about the awards and the accolades and the title of heroism and so forth because, you know, I could have gone there with the same courage, intent, and morality. If it had a different outcome, the judgment would have been very, very different. So I don't think anyone should take it too seriously when people tell you that you're a great fella.
I totally agree. You know, and so the thing that kept me up at night on like the Red Bull Stratus program was, did we do it right? You know, and is he properly prepared, and is this going to work? And if not, yeah, you lose someone that you love. Mm-hmm. You lose someone that you're intimately connected with. And so, yeah, I mean, this hero thing is overrated. It's like, do the work and do it well, and take the risks that make sense that you're capable of executing against. And so, I thank you for sharing. Thank you for bringing me to a place to appreciate the fragility of life even more, and as well as, you know, the edges and the boundaries of capabilities and the excitement that comes with that. And so, yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
All right. Thank you so much for diving into another episode of Finding Mastery with us. Our team loves creating this podcast and sharing these conversations with you. We really appreciate you being part of this community. And if you're enjoying the show, the easiest no-cost way to support is to hit the subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening. Also, if you haven't already, please consider dropping us a review on Apple or Spotify. We are incredibly grateful for the support and feedback. If you're looking for even more insights, we have a newsletter we send out every Wednesday. Punch over to findingmastery.com/newsletter to sign up. This show wouldn't be possible without our sponsors, and we take our recommendations seriously. And the team is very thoughtful about making sure we love and endorse every product you hear on the show. If you want to check out any of our sponsor offers you heard about in this episode, you can find those deals at findingmastery.com/sponsors. And remember, no one does it alone. The door here at Finding Mastery is always open to those looking to explore the edges and the reaches of their potential so that they can help others do the same. So join our community, share your favorite episode with a friend, and let us know how we can continue to show up for you. Lastly, as a quick reminder, information in this podcast and from any material on the Finding Mastery website and social channels is for information purposes only. If you're looking for meaningful support, which we all need, one of the best things you can do is to talk to a licensed professional. So seek assistance from your healthcare providers. Again, a sincere thank you for listening. Until next episode, be well, think well, and keep exploring.